about what's gone on with Sharon, where things are now. So could you do that first, Kathleen?
Barbara, I don't know if you want to.
Right, yeah, either of you, fine.
I can't see Barbara.
I'm happy if you do it, Kathleen.
Okay.
Although I've had some really wonderful conversations. I've called like 20 of her friends from different groups around the country, people she went to medical school with and people she went to college with and different meditation groups that she was part of. And she loved birding, I guess it's what you call it. She's a wonderful photographer. And she was part of the Raptor Society, and that was a real passion that kept her going, kept her grounded. She loved nature. She was an amazing nature photographer. So I've had these wonderful conversations with all these people that knew her from different parts of her life. It's been really kind of a wonderful way of grieving and mourning, but sweet.
So Sharon went into the hospital on Sunday night, and Barbara and I were there. And
I'm on a Zoom conference. I won't call you.
And then she died on Tuesday morning. And it happened, I think, very much the way that she wanted it to. And I'll add that she was a third generation Coloradoan, so she loved the mountains. She loved the mountains. And, you know, I'll just add a couple of things. Despite chronic pain, she was exposed to tuberculosis when she was 30, and that triggered her autoimmune system. And so for all those years, she was in chronic pain. But despite that, she always found a way to embrace life and to get out in the wilderness and to be able to do what she wanted to do. And she was very open and affectionate, and she was a committed spiritual seeker. And I also wanted to add that her father appreciates all the condolences and the metta that people have been sending to her. So thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. So just from interacting with Sharon on Sunday nights when she was able to be part of the group in person, and then somewhat later, you know, online and on a few one-on-one correspondences, my experience of Sharon is that not only did she have real respect for and interest in and involvement in exploring the natural world around her, but that she, that same interest and involvement and exploration applied equally to the inner life. It's like the same interest and engagement that she had with, you know, the things that she photographed and the places that she went. You know, she was equally interested in what's going on in the wilderness within me. what are some of the life forms of the species or the energies that are going on inside of me that I might want to learn more about, or that, you know, through noting or whatever, that I might want to photograph, or that I might want to become a better friend to, become more knowledgeable of. And so that, that spirit of inquiry, you know, of a medical scientist, of just a sentient, inquisitive being in the world, and someone whose commitment to being on a spiritual path never ended. And I think that, you know, and some of you who spent more time with her than I have may be able to attest to the fact that even as she knew she was coming close to the end of the path in this lifetime, that those questions and that form of inquiry became even more important to her, and that her Dharma practice was strong and getting stronger to the end. And I know that Kathleen and Barbara sat with her a lot, you know, maybe some other friends toward the end when she couldn't be with us in person. And so, yeah, she was one of us. She was very much a part of this Sangha. And so as a Sangha, we bid her well on her journey going forth, you know, however we choose to envision what that what may be going on for her right now. But at any rate, here we are. She's one of us. So as we settle in to do our practice tonight, we'll begin to do our insight meditation practice, beginning with Anapanasati. And then I will be suggesting that we devote some of our conscious energy as we begin to practice to the cultivation, the emanation, the sharing of metta, you know, of compassion, selfless joy, open-heartedness, equanimity, for her, for all who may be suffering in this time of contagion and the emergence from contagion. When in my own training, with the teachers from Spirit Rock Insight Meditation Center, you know, Joseph Goldstein wrote this book called One Dharma, where he was trying to say that across all the Dharma traditions in the West that are being brought to the West, there are certain commonalities they hold having to do with cessation of suffering. So in the Orthodox Theravada tradition, when one's life leaves one's body, then that transit of consciousness immediately arises in another being. In the Mahayana tradition, there is this little pause, there's this time in between after life leaves the body, when they call it moving into the bardo, the unknown. As you know, for those of you who've been sitting with me for a lot of years, you know, I'm not really particularly wedded to one form of spiritual scorekeeping or another, but I like to keep my mind open to the possibility that there is still this time of transitive passage, you know. And so I think that there's merit and value in us, as we sit together tonight, you know, not knowing, it's what the Lakota people call entering the mystery, not knowing what happens when life leaves the body, but just to spend a little time settling in, sending metta to ourselves, those who feel pain for her loss, sending metta to Sharon, if she may be available to receive it. And then just expanding that to others, you know, that we may know who are grieving the losses of loved ones, whether it be from COVID over the last 12 months or so, if any of us know any people who may have been associated with those who lost their lives in Boulder less than 2 weeks ago, a tragic mass murder. But just opening our hearts and being there in spirit for these powerful transitions that occur, you know, especially for the loss, beginning with the loss of a really cherished Sangha member, and remembering that, as she knew as well as any of us, all that arises must pass away. We experience and appreciate and cherish each other's presence while we're here, and we grieve them and we honor them as they move on their way. So let's settle in. Find our sitting posture. Get centered and relaxed. Whether we're in a chair or on a cushion or a bench, allowing the eyes to gently close, feeling a wave of warmth and relaxation move down through the body. Arms relaxed at our sides, hands folded perhaps in our laps or resting on our legs. Attention coming to rest on the breathing, whether we notice it mostly as the air moving in and out of the nostrils, or perhaps as the rising and falling of the abdomen, like the bellows before a furnace, rising and falling, energizing the core. Or perhaps the surface of the ocean on a calm day. Expressing their endless rhythmic energy. The wind flowing over the surface of the water. The endless rhythmic energy of the universe flowing through every cell of our being with each in-breath and each out-breath, each beat of the heart, each rhythmic vibration of every living cell of our being with the universe around us. Rising and falling, in and out, yin and yang, the energetic pulsation of the universe within us and around us. It has no beginning and it has no end. as the mind becomes more calm and clear, and able to more carefully discern all that which is going on within this mind-body complex, feeling the rhythmic pulsations of the universe as they manifest in the sensation of our skin touching our clothing or that which we are sitting upon. Feeling this flow of energy, these rhythmic pulsations, as sensations that we judge to be pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Sounds that we judge to be pleasant, unpleasant or neutral. The sensation of the breathing, the inflow and the outflow, like tidal waves, tidal currents flowing into and out of a tide pool, bringing in nourishment, carrying away that which is no longer needed. The rhythmic flow of nourishing and cleansing, nourishing and cleansing. The rhythmic flow of thoughts that may arise in the mind and that then are allowed to be carried away with the out-breath. Thoughts of the future and the past arising and passing away. Emotional states may be arising with the in-breath, the inflow, and then ebbing and flowing away with the out-breath. Whether we judge them to be pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Feeling these emotions and their energy, their form, and their connection to thoughts arising, filling the mind's eye like the tide pool, and then flowing out to sea. Continuous, ever-present rhythmic exchange. As is the case with our loved ones, they arise and they change and they pass away. Just like the tidal currents, the tidal pool that they inhabit during their lifetimes. Nourishment flowing in, creating a whole ecosystem of life within the mind-body process, and then flowing out to sea once again. Rising and changing and passing away. All those whom we hold dear, who once were with us and no longer are, arising and changing and passing away. The rhythmic interplay of energy waves in the universe, of which we are a part, ebbing and flowing like the tides of the ocean, breathing in and breathing out. Knowing that we are not separate, from all this flow that is the universe itself.
Thank you.
A few of the Buddha's teachings that I would like to sort of string together this evening and give us an opportunity to look at together and to discuss together, you know, after I've made a few comments. So to begin with, everything that the Buddha taught, all of his teachings, all of his lists, you know, there's the four foundations of mindfulness, or the Eightfold Path, or the obstacles to concentration, or the factors of enlightenment, you know, all of this, you know, these rich teachings. They have two complementary but different ways of understanding and engaging with. And one is their application when we're doing meditation practice, when we're in samadhi, when we're cultivating the qualities of mindfulness and effort and concentration. And so then we can note, you know, whether there is one of the hindrances to concentration arising, you know, whether it's lust, attachment, aversion, sluggishness of mind, anxiety and worry, doubt, you know. So we can rip through that list, so we can look at them in a kind of a passive way. And then the states of mind that we can cultivate in a more active way while we're in meditation. You know, things like the Brahma Vihara is open-heartedness and selfless joy, equanimity, compassion. So whether it's just the noting of these or the active cultivation of them, we can do that while we're sitting, while we're quiet and clear-minded and at ease. But the other application, or the other way of making these teachings a part of our lives, has to do with daily life, you know, which is you're out on the street, or you're behind the wheel of your car, or you're in conversation with somebody, you're in line at the market, or you're interacting with the world. And in the course of that interaction, you are invited, or you are drawn to be with others or interact with others in certain ways. And so that's, you know, where the Dharma hits the dirt, you know. It's like, okay, here we are, you know, now we're out in the street, now we're living life in the moment, you know, and it's coming at us. And so how are we going to be in this moment? How are we going to take in the energy of the people around us? How are we going to respond to it? How are we going to be? And so that's no less an element of what it means to practice the Dharma than whatever we do when we're, you know, on the cushion or on our bench or our seat. What I want to do this evening is share with you the teachings of the Buddha on this subject, but also as kind of filtered through a recent personal experience. And I feel self-conscious, because sometimes it feels like when I'm teaching the Dharma, I talk too much about myself and my personal dramas. But I also find that when I do that, it's like this stuff's for real. You know, this is, you know, I do that as a way of it, as kind of, you know, saying this is how I've sought to embody the Dharma and what I'm facing. And and then it's just an invitation for you to do the same thing. Anything that I talk about that that's relevant to you, and that's what I hope we can discuss together. If you come across any of the same kinds of stuff, then by all means, it's what we need to talk about. So anyway, a couple of days ago, and I've spoken about this sometimes in the past, I've got kind of a wonky heart, you know, that I have this condition, this paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. And every once in a while, you know, and as my cardiologist told me, it, these events when the heart gets bored doing the two-step and wants to do the tango, or maybe a little slam dancing, or maybe just take a break, you know. As he said, that these episodes are going to happen with increasing frequency and for increasing periods of time. And so I had an episode a few days ago that it came on unexpectedly, and it became more and more insistent, and was not resolving itself. And so as I became more anxious about the fact that the heart was out of rhythm, and my wife did too, even though my cardiologist had said, well, you know, it'll last for however long it's going to last, and it'll probably come back into normal rhythm or not. And so it's up to you what you want to do about that. You know, if you just want to wait and see if it comes around on its own, or if you need to go in to be seen and treated. And so after about 2 days or so, I became increasingly anxious and fearful. And I think my wife kind of played off that, Abby did. And so it just kind of went back and forth. And so eventually we said, well, okay, we probably ought to go to the ER. And so we did that. And they did a workup on me, and they said, oh yeah, your heart's really whacked out, and took me into, you know, a treatment room, and pokes and prods and needles and monitors and looking at what's going on. Oh yeah, you're an AFib, yeah, it's pretty screwed up, and no wonder you're having trouble keeping your balance and walking and whatnot. And and I had gone into the ER in a real state of agitation and worry and fear, and as had my wife. And then I was lying there on the table, and with all this stuff going on, and there's this teaching from Buddha Dharma that it was really kind of in the back of my mind, and all of a sudden it came to the forefront. And it's this set of teachings on what are called the paramis in Theravada Buddhism, or the perfections in Mahayana Buddhism. And it's these qualities of mind of calm, focused, abiding, courage, and living in harmony, and generosity, and patience or constancy, and wisdom, that had not been accessible to me at all, you know, on this event. And yet somehow when I was lying there on the, you know, in the treatment room in the ER with the monitors going and the needles and, you know, all that good stuff, that somehow they just arose and they were there. And an altogether different state of consciousness arose for me while we were in there. And so after they'd done a bunch of blood work and all that, the doctors started rolling in with lab results and such, and said, well, you know, the first ER doc said, well, why are you here? And I said, well, I'm here because I'm in atrial fibrillation. Well, duh, you know. And he said, how long have you had this condition? And I said, 17 years. And he said, did your cardiologist advise that you come in whenever you've been in AFib for this long? And I said, well, not necessarily. What he told me was that it's a degenerative heart condition. It's gradually going to get worse over time. And then after a while, another doc came in and he said, there are a couple of different ways we could go here. He said, we get a lot of AFib patients here in the ER. And the ways that we could, there's two things at work. One is the way we can treat you right now, and the other is how you live with atrial fibrillation, you know, down the road. And he said, we have people come in here who are freaked out about, you know, whose minds have become agitated and fearful about the fact that they're in atrial fibrillation, and aren't sure what to do about it. He said, there's different things we can do for you right now, but there are people out there in the world who live with atrial fibrillation about half the time in their lives, you know, that their lives are out of whack, you know, their hearts are out of whack an awful lot of the time. He said, right now, if you wish, and this is about 10 o'clock at night, ER, said, we can administer a pretty powerful drugs to you that are probably going to bring the heart back into normal rhythm, but then we need to admit you for the night, you know, make sure everything works out okay. And he said, the other thing we can do is rip out the paddles and do an electroconversion shock, you know, put me out first and then do an electroconversion, which, and then be admitted. Both of which are, you know, kind of even more of an insult to the heart than what it's already experiencing. And then he said, and the other thing you can do is just to write it out, just to allow it to revert to a normal rhythm, which you'll probably do, you know, another day or two. And so, I don't know, there was something, and then he said, think about it, and my wife Abby was there in the room with me, think about it and let me know what you'd like to do. And so just lying there on the table, there was this array of teachings that had been completely inaccessible to me when we decided to come into the ER, but all of a sudden they were just there. They just manifested these perfections, the paramis, the paramitas, and they just all kind of presented themselves, and like, oh, okay, the courage to sit with what's happening, the calmness of mind that allows that to happen, the reflection on what would be the kindest thing for me, for my wife, for all these people in the ER who have a lot of other things going on, being shot and stabbed and, you know, getting ready to die of a heart attack and whatnot. And some sense of patience and grace. And all of a sudden that mind state just kind of took over, right? And I sort of just lay there for a few minutes. And then we came back and said, what do you want to do? And said, well, you know, I'd like to go home. And so we did. We packed it in. We went back home again. Sat for a little while and then went to bed. And about 10 a.m. the next morning, the heart reverted to a normal rhythm. So what I'm talking about is a set of teachings that was not accessible to me at the time when I was getting freaked out about, you know, the heart being in trouble, but that when I was in this state of genuine kind of at a crossroads, all right, you know, what do you want to do next? You know, all of a sudden it kicked in big time, and these strengths or qualities of mind that had not been available before were there with real effect. And so they kind of took over and they took us home. And so it's that I want to speak about this evening. In Theravada practice, they're called the paramis. And in the Mahayana, it's the paramitas. Okay? The word is usually translated as the perfections, which is especially for us here in the West, the worst possible translation of that term. And that's because of like what Trungpa Rinpoche, he wrote a whole book called, it was on the subject of what he called spiritual materialism. And it was, by that, what he meant was the ego's obsession with trying to become enlightened, trying to awaken when, and it's the great cosmic practical joke of the Dharma, because the ego becomes obsessed with enlightenment when in fact enlightenment or awakening consists of the cessation of the construction of ego. You know, it's like what Jack Kornfield used to say was, you know, it's like the ego wants to be present for its own funeral. So, you know, creating in the self a desire to be free of the self. It's just not how it works, right? And so this obsession with perfection, you know, can be maddening for people, those of us who are practicing Buddha Dharma, because it's this very urge to perfection that is the ego at work. It's the urge to perfection that prevents liberation, right? And that's a really hard one to get your head around, get the mind around. In the Sun Chen Ming, the verses on the faith mind, or the third Zen elder, he said, to live in the great way is to be without anxiety about imperfection. You know, it's to accept yourself just as you are. And then all of a sudden, this set of teachings crops up called, you know, the paramitas, the perfections. Not a good translation. If you really dig down into the root meaning of parami or paramita, the dynamic that's more kind of at work it's like as if you were like when they dig up the ore of precious metals, gold or silver or copper or something like that, and the metal is bonded to the rock, the earth that's around. So they take the rock with the precious metal in it to a smelter, and they crush it up into little pieces, and then they put it in the furnace under really, really high heat, and gradually the essence, the metals that they're trying to extract, liquefy and melt out. Okay. And then the slag, the rest of the stuff, they, you know, shove over the side. So it may be more useful to think about, instead of the perfections being something that you do, like there's a song from the 1920s, I'll build a stairway to paradise, you know, as if there is some kind of activity that you're going to do that's going to make you smarter and more compassionate and, you know, and more patient and all that. As if it's something you acquire, whereas the deeper understanding of the perfections, the purification is, it's more like smelting away the stuff that gets in the way. And it's the understanding that these paramis, these qualities of mind, are, it's like they've been there all along. They're inside. They reside within us. And that when we do this practice, when we're really, we really focus on seeking to be every more mindful with kind intention. You know, when we really just work with, you know, not with trying to achieve something, not with hammering away at ourselves, or, but when we really just patiently and kindly do this practice with kind intention for our own well-being and that of others, that it's like the heat in the furnace, and these other things begin to float away, and the essences that remain are these very things that are talked about in these teachings. We find that the mind is more calm and clear and settled and focused, and that there is an element of courage, of steadfastness that is helping us along the way, and that we, the heart opens, we feel more generous to ourselves and others, and there is a sense of patience or constancy, not wanting everything to happen all at once, and a kind of an expansion of the mind, a sort of wisdom that occurs just on its own, not because it's something we tried to make happen, but because it's something that is, it's been there all along, trying to come forward. And so, I think maybe for all of us, this practice is a lot about when things like this, these qualities of mind that we know are in there already, at what point, when we're in kind of a stressful or difficult situation, can we remember that they're there and that they've been there all along? So when I was at home getting more and more concerned, more anxious, more worried about what was going on in the heart and whatnot. For whatever reason, the anxiety and the fear were powerful enough that the recognition of those other qualities of mine was not available. It's not there. It was not, they were not there in a way that could inform my decision making in the moment, that could calm me, you know, and help me appreciate the qualities of peace and courage, patience that were necessary to live through the situation. And so got freaked out, we ran off to the ER, and they did the stuff that they do in the ER. And then when they were on the verge of saying, okay, do you want to get shocked? Do you want to take this intrusive action to bring them the heart back into a normal rhythm so that you won't be worried or afraid anymore? Or do you just want to be with the situation as it is and see how it unfolds? So in some ways, it was like I'd gone into this this like Thai temple to have these people, in their white coats and saying, presenting the Dharma to me. It's like saying, okay, we can zap you back into a normal rhythm, you know, and we can get rid of your immediate fears, or you can go home and see whether the body is going to figure out a way to take care of it. So, it was humbling, but it was also revelatory in a way, because it helped reground me in the fact that the wisest decision to be made in the time was there all along, you know. And so part of our learning to do this practice is to see if we can figure out a way. And these really important lessons to present themselves a little earlier in the game, you know, to be able to crop up before we make the decision to go to the ER, instead of when we're already on the table with all the tubes and the sensors going in and out. So I want to provide some more, a little bit more background information about the Dharma's. But first, I'd like to just hang and talk, you know, and share, because I think all of us at some point have been faced with a situation like that. So please, anyone who would like to, you know, ask a question or share a thought or a feeling, please, now is a good time. Do it through chat, you can raise your hand, unmute and speak out.
Can you guys see me?
James, yes.
Howdy. Your story really reminded me of a time that I had to get a pretty like minor surgery, and for some reason I was a really kind of like low, I remember this was a couple years back in the summer, and I was very low energy, kind of feeling depressed going into it. But then like the day of the surgery, for some reason, I mean, I was very nervous, like I barely got any sleep, but I kind of just perked up, and like I felt like suddenly I could handle it, and you know, conversing with the people in the pre-op, I felt like there was this courage that I totally surprised me. Totally took me. Like I never thought that I had this inside of me, but I think it carried on for a few days, which was great. It really made it helpful, and I was able to like, all right, well, I feel really weak, but I can do some walking meditation. So the kind of like wisdom to know what practice to do was there too.
Yes. Right.
But yeah, yeah. I don't know. It hasn't really happened since too much, so I can't say like I've perfected that one.
Oh no, but I really appreciate what you're saying, because it's the recognition that, oh wow, there is actually this resource within me, you know, the anxiety or the fear or whatever may arise, but when you've got even, you know, just a little taste of the Dharma, or your mind's been able to rest in that space for a while, you've been able to begin to train the mind to see what's going on. It's remarkable when all of a sudden, bingo, it's just kind of there for you, you know. And getting back to, you know, linking up with the themes and the retreat that Joe was talking about a few moments ago, one of the aspects of my experience of atrial fibrillation my discursive mind takes a genuine perverse delight in is that I have there are these certain default settings or capabilities that the mind has. So whenever I go into AFib, one of the first mind states that comes up for me is self-pity. It's like, oh my God, poor me, this is horrible. Why, you know, why is this going on for me? Look at how it's clouded and, you know, and detracted from my life and so on and so forth. And the other is that my cardiologist told me a while ago when, you know, I was struggling with this condition, and it was in the events were becoming a little more frequent and longer. He said, well, you know, all the research out there tells you that if you were to lose between 5 and 10% of your body weight and exercise for at least a half an hour every day, that would probably be just as effective in managing your AFib as any medication I could give. And so that really, you know, energized my resolve to exercise more and to lose weight. And it got as far as energizing my resolve. It did not get as far as me exercising more and losing weight. And so, you know, one of my default settings that the discursive mind gets a real kick out of course, is self-pity. And the other is self-condemnation. Because now, whenever an AFib event occurs, it's a wonderful opportunity to say, oh, you worthless sack of shit. If you had only been exercising more, and if you had only been minding your diet, you wouldn't be having AFib right now, right? And so it's like, it's not only the second dart, you know, first is the suffering, the third, you know, the second is the aversion to the suffering you're experiencing. And the third one is, of course, you know, attacking yourself for being aversive to the fact that you're suffering. And so it's like all of this stuff happens at once. And so when I was lying there on the table in the yards, I could see that one happening too, you know? And so, you know, that's the whole shtick that Joe and Deborah are going to be working on, you know, which is, look at the mind. Like, why does it do that? You know, the mind is not our friend when it's doing those things, you know. It's really important to recognize when that's what the mind is up to, and this whole business about self-forgiveness and whatnot. And so that these lessons of the Dharma are so powerful and so important to, you know, when things like this come along. So these paramis, these perfections, again, terrible word, these essences of mind that lie within us that just through, again, it's like a smelting process, that through the steady practice of mindfulness, self-compassion, that these qualities just arise. In 2012, I was on sabbatical, serving on the faculty in the School of Law at the University of Barcelona in Catalonia in northeastern Spain. And my host there was the associate dean of the law school. And as it turns out, he was really getting interested in the Dharma. And about 50 miles south of Barcelona in the coastal hills was a Tibetan Buddhist meditation center that was just getting started. And the abbot there, the Rinpoche, had invited me to come down and give a talk and spend some time there, because they were trying to build out their meditation center, and they knew that I had, you know, was a co-founder of the Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Marin County, California. So we went down there and spent some time and gave a talk to his sangha, and they had a little gift shop where we stayed there. And so while we were there, we there is this little set of like refrigerator magnets that had, each of them had the word for one of the paramitas with one of the Tibetan Buddhist symbols of it, you know. And so we bought those and bought this little set, brought it home. It's in our kitchen right now. And so there's something that's helpful for me about having these spelled out there on the wall of the, in the kitchen, just above our pots and pans, in Spanish, because somehow if I repeat them in Spanish, they stick in there a little bit more. So the first of the six, concentración, samadhi, you know, and that means as the practice of the Dharma gets deeper, begins to stabilize the mind becomes more calm and clear and able to see what's going on. Second one, coraje, courage. That one of the things that happens for us in daily life is that when times get tough, that we want to run and hide. We'll find any way we can to run and hide. And so coraje, courage, means being able to just be there with what's going on in the moment without running away from it. Ética y moral, sila, living in harmony. Just expressing your life in the world in a way that's in harmony with the universe seeking to bring suffering to an end. Living both internally and externally with others in a way that brings suffering to an end. And audacidad, generosity. Opening the heart, sharing what you have with others, taking in what others have to share with you, relaxation of boundaries. Paciencia. It's really usually most frequent English translation is patience. Just hanging in. Just, you know, being with things as they are, without it coming, some kind of like urge to change things, or change, is more, most importantly, change yourself. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master said, well, you know, not so sure about patience as a translation, because it means like you're sitting around waiting for something to happen. He said the word he likes better is constancy, you know, which is just being here. Just be there. Just be there. Don't run away. Don't have an expectation of things getting better in the next moment. Just be there. Just this. Just this. Just now. And sabiduría, wisdom, you know, the wise open mind that can see everything as it is, rather than seeing things only through the prism of how we wish they were. So those are the terrible word. Perfections, the essences, the qualities of mind that lie within, that are there all the time, that are waiting to be discovered and acknowledged. And just like, you know, what happened to me in the ER, it's as if sometimes we have to go through this smelting process, you know, this furnace of dukkha or whatever, in order for them to be made manifest. Oh, there we are. There we are. There's the samadhi, the calmness of mind. Oh, there it is. There is the courage that keeps me where I am right here in this moment. Oh, there it is. There is the desire to live in harmony. There is the generosity. There is the patience of the constancy. There is the wisdom. There are, there, not here are, here within me, within each one of us, are these essences that help us to live life to its fullest. So, I'm sorry I've waxed a little too eloquent. Here we are, all the way up to 8 p.m., and we've run out of time. This is as long as we commit to being together, but since I did run over, I'm happy to hang out for a little while. So, if anyone would like to discuss any longer, anything that I've spoken of this evening, we can be together for a few more minutes. And for those of you who, you know, need to go on and do what's next, please do. So here I am for a while. Let's chat if you wish to, either in the chat column or just raise your hand and we'll talk.
Thanks, dear Lloyd.
I think Sally has something. Sally, is up?
Please.
Oops. Sorry. Actually, I was just raising my hand to say goodbye because I am going to sign off. But thank you, Lloyd. That was very helpful to me. And it's hard to be patient, but
I... Tell me about it. Okay. Very good, Sally. Glad you were here tonight. Take care. Stay safe and be well.
Everybody.
I've got my hand raised.
Is that Julie?
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, Carol Lloyd. Really enjoyed your talk this evening. I think you proved to yourself, by going home and what you went through and everything, I think you proved to yourself that you're really trusting your body wisdom, and that wisdom mm-hmm. is very much connected to your mind. And
sure, of course.
I think that, you know, the diet and exercise, you know, that's what the doctors say, but I think nothing is as powerful as really deeply trusting your your body wisdom and your mind and working with your mind.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Thank you. I appreciate your sharing that.
Yeah, no, it was really a heartfelt talk, and my heart goes out to you. And
okay.
And
the gentleness
and the love in your talk tonight. When you began, I said to myself, I bet he's been through one of those AFib things again. Because of it brought you to your knees in a sense. And
oh, yes. Very humbling.
Yes.
That's how it works.
Yeah, humbling. Right. So thank you very much. It was beautiful. Thank you.
Okay,
all.
Good. Appreciate that. Mm-hmm.
Tara Lloyd, what would you like to call the talk?
Oh, maybe just the paramis, P-A-R-A-M-I-S.
Okay, thanks. And my computer monitor went out, so that's why I had...
Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks for your service, Luke, in recording these talks. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. That was a great talk. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.